Well, because I figured it's your fingers. They're going to be like, stop doing whatever you were doing.
Yeah.
It'll heal itself.
It hurts when I lift my arm. Yeah, don't lift your arm. Yeah. So it's a lovely Tuesday morning. It's let's talk photos. Let's talk or you know, let's say we're going to talk photos and then talk
something else.
it is Tuesday. It is On Taking Pictures, the weekly podcast about photography, making images, and oh so much more. I'm Jeffrey Sidoris, and with me, Mr. Bill Wadman.
The broken-handed.
Yeah, the broken-handed. Yeah, Bill, okay, so quick story. Bill says to me last week, mind you.
Yeah.
I think I might have broken my fingers or broken something in my knuckles, my hand. And he thinks that, you know, it's just going to heal itself. And now here we are a week later. Is it better, Bill?
Heal thyself.
Yeah.
No, it's not better. I got to go get it checked out today.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, as a photographer, yeah. I would imagine, and again, I'm speculating,
that I need your hand. You need your hands.
You need your hands. Yeah.
It's my left hand, so I don't need it as much. just to hold the reflector.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're Bruce Gilden, you need it to hold the flash.
Yeah. But yeah, I got to go get that checked out. You know what it is? You ever have that thing where you're like, okay, make a fist and then you open up and just as you get to sort of straight finger, you hear you feel a click in your,
no,
you
I don't talking ever, about. I don't ever feel that.
Then that's what's wrong with my finger, whatever that is.
Then
I'm going to go get it checked out. It's going to happen. So we're going to do it today. All right. So we got some stuff to go through today.
I told you so you.
Yeah, I know. We have a question from last week that we didn't get around to because it was
right,
a bigger
big question.
All right. And then we have a few other little topics. We've got some bad news. We've got and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the flash stuff that I've figured out, and we're going to do our photographer of the week. So we got a good show. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like weren't there two questions from last week we didn't get to?
Yes, and I can't remember what the other one was.
All right, well...
Wait, can we go back? Or wait, it was toward the end.
Yeah, it was towards the end. Was it the $1 million budget? It was, but I don't have a good answer for that, so maybe we'll have to do that next time.
Yes.
Who, how, and why?
Right.
We're going to have to pull that out for next week. I got to think about that one. I don't even know what the answer would be.
I would do like some sort of crazy Gregory Crudson shoot.
Of course you would. There's a guy already doing that. What's his name? Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Gregory Crudson. All right. So what's the question?
So Bobby Tingle writes in and asked, how do you decide when to throw in the towel on something, whether it's a concept, a project, a piece of gear, etc.? How do you decide between I haven't given something enough time versus this just isn't going to work? I love this question.
Of course, because it doesn't have an answer.
No, it does. That's true.
Okay, it's got a myriad of answers, right?
Yes. Yes.
You know what's interesting about this one? I think in some ways it comes down to intent, right? Or what your goals are.
Sure.
So let's say it's a career thing, right? Like, oh, I've been trying to be a screenwriter for 10 years and it hasn't worked yet. So therefore I'm going to give up. Let's just use that as an example.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that becomes, okay, well, what is your goal? Is your goal to write screenplays or is your goal to make a living writing screenplays or something? You know what I mean? Like
some combination of the two.
Exactly.
Sure.
Because you know, it may be that you've spent 10 years writing screenplays and none of them have gotten turned into big budget Hollywood movies, but you've spent the last 10 years writing screenplays and you really enjoyed that. Well, then you don't really need to give up on it or throw the towel in. It depends on how you define your own success.
Yes. In some of the simplest terms, though they're not always simple to execute, we can go back to Seth Godin. And one of his mantras is you run out of time or you run out of money. It's time. That's when you ship.
Right. Yeah.
Now you could extrapolate that into that's when you stop. Right.
Right. So when you die or.
Yeah. 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 But an anecdote, if you don't mind.
Sure.
In 1989, I had just retired. I had just retired. That's right. I was playing golf, and I was working at a special effects company in LA. Practical special effects, and a new person started who had just moved from Louisiana.
Okay.
And he moved to LA to be an actor. He had done off-Broadway. He had done a bunch of improv. He had done a couple short films, independent, you know, films, and moved to LA. And I was the second person that he met when he moved to LA.
Okay.
Might have been 88, actually. No. No, I think it was 89 or 90. Anyway, a long time ago. So he had the passion. He had the drive. He had the credits at that point, you know, somewhat of a pedigree of, look, here's the proof that I can do this.
Yep.
But for whatever reason, it never, the acting part never clicked.
Never gelled.
No, but he is also a very good writer, and he started getting writing gigs, which led to directing and producing. And fast forward to, you know, 2015, mm-hmm. he still hasn't done it as an actor, but he's produced hundreds of hours of television. He's produced and directed one of Neil Gaiman's short stories into a short film, where Neil has become one of his friends. He's developing a project right now with Steven Soderbergh, who has also become one of his friends. You know, he's in the Producers Guild, he's in the Directors Guild, and he has given himself little parts, and in the last couple of years has gotten small roles as an actor. And I've talked to him about it several times. He's one of the people I want to talk to for the show. It's interesting because his dream, instead of playing second base, he's playing right field.
Right. And does he still have the dream of wanting to be an actor?
I think that's still his, well, I know that's still where he gets the most charge. Being on set, he did a TV show a couple months ago, and he got to work with James Caan. He got to do a few scenes with James Caan. Who is one of his sort of bucket list icon, top 10 actors to work with. And said he was just a total sweetheart and really great to work with. That's what gives him the most joy, but he's kind of altered his dream, where it's still in the same ballpark, to use that sports metaphor again, but it's different. And had he completely thrown in the towel and said, okay, Hollywood's just not for me, he would have missed out on this incredible run of experiences in another area.
Right. Do you think the story would be different if back up, take a branch off from branch it off from when he moves to LA.
Right.
He tries to be an actor, and for whatever reason, it's not working, or people aren't hiring him, or whatever, the roll of the dice. Right.
Right.
And he falls into directing and falls in love with directing.
I think,
because that kind of stuff happens too.
Yeah.
I mean, look at me. I'm doing photography, but I never planned to be a photographer, you know?
Agreed.
So that kind of stuff happens too, right?
Sure. And yeah. I would imagine that Jude would say he is in love with directing, but, you know, acting is still his first love.
Yeah.
You know, because he doesn't do anything half-assed. He doesn't do anything, you know, it's either he puts everything into it, or he doesn't want to do it. And that's, he's got a ton of integrity in that way. And that's one of the things that's been difficult is there are a lot of people in LA, a lot of people in entertainment that don't have that level of integrity. And there are compromises that they want you to make. And
sure.
He doesn't compromise. He sticks to these core beliefs. And, you know, we've had a lot of conversation about that of, would it be different if you compromised a little bit more? And maybe, but to his credit, he's not willing to.
Right. Yeah, sure. But I think that's to me, not compromising that way. I find some virtue in that.
But, absolutely.
But even putting it on another level, I think that's perfectly fine. You know,
I do too. And I have an enormous amount of respect for him. He's one of my best friends in the world, and I'm just, I tell this story to say that if he, you know, again, to illustrate that if he had given up on it, that there is this whole other thing that would not have had the chance to happen.
Yeah.
Now there are times when you probably should give up.
Yeah. There's times when you wring it out and there's nothing left.
It just doesn't work.
I think in some ways the answer to Bobby's question is a really simple one. And it's like when your gut says that you're done, you know?
Right.
I remember Tony Vaccaro told me a story about, I think it was about Chaplin. And Chaplin was directing some movie. And in it, two people had a kissing scene, right? They run up to each other, very like 1940s movie. They kiss, and then, you know. And he was directing it, and Tony was on set when this happened. And as they were about to kiss, he said, "All right, action, and kiss, and break." You know, like that, right? So he like basically timed the kiss.
Okay.
But he did this, turned around away from the people acting. He was like staring off into nothingness as he was directing the people who were then behind him in some way. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And he later asked, he was talking to Chaplin. And he's like, I had to feel the length of the kiss, you know? Like the length of that kiss mattered, and the only way I could decide on what the right answer was to turn around and sort of get myself in what would feel right for me. In the same way that somebody with a, you know, yellow paint on their brush does a brush stroke and knows when to pull off, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in some ways, that's what gives all of this its humanity. That's what gives all of it. That's what makes art art, you know, in some way. So it's interesting. So, you know, he talks about smaller stuff like concept or a project or a piece of gear. It's like there is no right or wrong answer, I don't think. You know, it's what's right or wrong for you.
Well, and you said something earlier about intent and purpose. If your intent is to make a living doing X, let's use photography.
Yeah, sure.
Well, then it's pretty easy to, and that's all you're doing. You don't have another job.
Right.
You've decided, okay, I'm going to put all my time and effort into being a professional photographer or a photographer who earns his entire living by photography.
Right.
Well, that's a little bit easier to define because
it's quite literally quantifiable.
Yeah. When you run out of money.
Yeah. How much money do I need to live? Am I making that much money? Yes,
right.
Or no.
And if not, then you have to supplement that or, you know,
or go massively into debt.
Right.
Like some people do.
Which some people do.
Yeah.
But
even there, like let's take the debt thing. There are people who would say, you know, I really want to make this movie. You could be Kevin Smith, you know. I'm going to take out a bunch of credit cards and put $20,000 on credit cards so I could make Clerks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably a really, there are many people, half of the world would probably say that's a terrible idea to basically put yourself in debt that you could never get out of unless it's successful. Right. That's putting it all on the line. Some people would say that's stupid. Other people would say, no, you got to do anything for your art. So like two people have completely different views of the same thing. You know?
That is true. That is true. There is still a time though. I mean, even using that example, he's going to run out of debt at some point. He's going to run out of credit at some point.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, you could argue that those limitations, those walls you're about to slam into, also give you much more incentive to try to make something work. Working well under pressure.
Sure, sure. Now, Bobby, I don't know if you're making your living from photography, but if you are not, then that idea of when to throw in the towel becomes much harder to define. If it is, because look, photography is a never ending journey.
Yep.
Any art is a never ending journey. You're always learning. You're always adding to your kit, adding to your toolbox, whether that's metaphorically or literally. So when do you, let's see.
I think it's, I mean, as far as like projects and stuff go, there are plenty of things that I've started that didn't work out the way I wanted them to. And I let them go cause it didn't work.
Mm-hmm. You know,
that happens all the time. I think that there's part of me that feels guilty for not taking them further sometimes. You know, where I feel like I let myself down by letting go of an idea before it was fully, you know, done. There, years ago, I started a project where I shot diptychs of people who had lost their jobs during the downturn. And I shot, it was basically the same shot. They might have been a different pose, but otherwise it was like the same environment, with them in their work clothes and what they wore at home when they didn't have a job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I did, I think, 3 or 4 of them, and they came out great and they looked good and they were fine, but they didn't have any magic for me. They didn't hold my interest. And it's funny because I've showed them to people since then after the fact and people really liked them. So it's like this interesting thing where they said, oh, you should have kept doing that. And I was like, yeah, it didn't stoke my fire at all. In the same way that your friend, how he gets, you know, he gets his joy out of doing the acting stuff. It's like you can't, in the same way that you can't choose who you fall in love with.
Sure.
You can't choose what kind of gets your creative juices going or not.
Right.
You know, it's some things work and some things don't. And there's like, and if it's not working, well, maybe it's not going to work. That's okay. Move on to the next thing. You know, be a creative entrepreneur. Just try a bunch of things until one of them works.
Yeah, the one thing that is often hard to wrap your head around is the idea that you can't gauge, nor can you control how an audience is going to react.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's one of the reasons that there is so much noise. It's one of the reasons that photographers, let's use them since that's ostensibly what the show's about, have a website and a Flickr account and a 500 pixels account and an Instagram account and a Facebook account. Now, what we know from the listener survey is that the vast majority of you guys use Facebook.
Right. I think the vast majority of, you know, people on the internet use Facebook.
Right. But Facebook has become a different audience than, say, Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Instagram is a different audience than 500 pixels.
Yep.
So in an effort to reach more people, which you may or may not be doing by having these multiple services, you may in fact be simply creating more noise.
Yeah.
If your target audience doesn't use one or more of these services, you're not reaching them anyway. So all you're doing is creating more noise for people to have to cut through to get to what's important to you, to get to what's really your jam.
But what's the alternative to that?
Well, that's what everybody's looking for.
Right.
And now if your audience,
I don't think everyone wants to be on all those things. I think that they feel like they need to be or have to be.
Sure. Everybody's looking for a way to reach their audience, but right. You know, it's our non-photographers, let's say.
Yeah.
Is your audience looking to 500 pixels to find the work that they want, or the people that they want to hire?
No, I think
maybe not.
500 pixels is photographers showing to photographers, in my opinion.
Okay. And same thing with, you know, Instagrams and these platforms change. Okay. Facebook used to be the platform of the young.
Yep.
Now it's not. Now they've moved on.
Oh yeah. They're all on what, Snapchat?
Yeah, because all of their parents signed up for Facebook, so now they're like, you know, screw this, we want to go somewhere else. Right. Instagram was at one point not taken as seriously as it is now.
Yep.
But now you've got art buyers, you've got Fortune 500 companies, you've got large scale and small scale clients looking to Instagram to hire their next people to shoot their campaigns or to create their next, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. But so, even there, it's interesting because it feels it's a certain kind of photographer who they're looking for on, say, Instagram. And it could be just that they're not looking there. It's that they're on Instagram and follow a bunch of people and see a picture that they like. Right. You know,
sure. Maybe
rather than saying, I'm going to go look for, you know, beach photographers and I'm going to go look on Instagram to find them. I think it's like they see a beach photography picture on Instagram and they notice it or like it, or you know what I mean?
Maybe.
Didn't mean to.
No. It's all right. I think that all of this stuff has made it so difficult to Bobby's question to know when something is working or not.
Well,
it may work great. The work that you're producing may be fabulous.
Yeah.
But you're showing it on the wrong platform, so it's not garnering the response or the feedback or the results that you want. And the assumption then is, well, the work's not good enough, or the work's not right, or the work's not this or that.
Right. Well, it's nearly impossible to figure out a return on investment.
Sure.
Of time or energy or money, you know. I am a member on Foundfolios, I think, you know, one of those sort of pay us $1,000 a year and we'll feature your stuff, whatever it is.
Is it like a black book or a drip book?
Yeah. Like one of those things.
Yeah.
And so I'm a featured member on up there right now. And my thing is coming up for renewals soon. And it's like, I really can't decide if it's worth it, you know, because it's a lot of money. So it's sort of one of these things where it's like, well, maybe somebody did see me, but they haven't called to hire me yet. Or maybe they'll see me tomorrow, or maybe I need to do that for 3 years. And yeah, it'll cost $4,000 to do that, but you get one job for 40 grand and that $4,000 doesn't look so bad anymore. You know, you never know, right? You never know any of this stuff. And that's what's so frustrating about, a lot of stuff on social media. I mean, even like, you know, famously on the show, like I started using Instagram recently. It's like, okay, so now I put stuff on Instagram. And well, what about the people who don't look at Instagram? Well, I still put on my blog. Well, how do people find my blog? Well, that means I feed it to Twitter. Well, that ends up going to Facebook, and Instagram ends up going to Facebook. And it, you know, you end up having these things where you almost have to do it on, you feel like you need to do it on all those things because no one of them is covering everybody, as you were saying.
Right.
And but then you're just complicating so much of your life, and you're trying so desperately to cling or to build an audience, or, you know, whatever the word you want to use are.
Sure.
That sometimes it feels like Sisyphus, you know?
Yeah. And the stone just keeps getting bigger. The stone is noise.
Yeah.
And you're trying to push the noise up the hill and out of the way so you can get that moment of clarity.
Right. You know,
you can stand at the top of the mountain and you can see this sort of unencumbered view of the valley. But we're creating more and more noise so that it becomes more and more difficult for people like Bobby to go, is it me or is it you?
Yeah. Yeah. It is by attempting to find clarity, you're adding to the noise.
Yes.
But by trying to get out of the hot room, you're actually creating more heat and moving to get to the door.
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, very few of us know what, you know, what's going to hit.
Take commerce out of it. What is successful in the first place? How do you know? You know, I mean, you know, Bobby could be working on something and he doesn't think it's working, but it might be working great to other people. You know what I mean? Like his perception of it isn't correct. You know, I'm just using correct in loose terms.
Sure.
You know, so it goes, you can swing that all different ways. I had a thing the other day. I think as good a time as I need to bring this up. I had this shoot for this magazine and I took pictures of this woman and I wasn't happy with the pictures. I mean, they were fine, but there was nothing special about them. And, I was nervous sending them to the art director of the magazine because I was not embarrassed, but I was like a little like, oh God, I wish I could do that over again. Or, you know, I would have done something different if I had to do over again. And I even procrastinated sending them over to him. And I sent them over to him waiting for him to be like, yeah, these will do. Or, you know what I mean? Like, oh, well, didn't get it that time, you know, like
we don't have time to redo it, but this will
work. We'll use these. Yeah. And sure. I mean, and when it comes to magazine work, for those of you who don't do it, it is very much, if you get somebody who keeps calling you, that's a really good thing, obviously. And if you put in bad work, they might not call you next time. Right. So it's a very much a, what have you done for me lately kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so I was worried because this guy's, you know, a good client of mine. And he sends back this email and he was just like, oh, you knocked it out of the park. Like, I love working with you. You know, you always get what I need. And I was like, that's really funny.
You're
because
like that?
Yeah, exactly. Right. But I have done other jobs for portraits for clients where I take the pictures. I think they're pretty good. I send them over to them. And one guy threatened to sue me for his money back because he hated him so much. So. Right. So there are your understanding of what is good in your own work is incredibly difficult because, you know, your way of rating things is completely different than the viewer. And if the viewer is the client, that's a whole other thing. But getting back to it, it's like apparently these pictures are OK, you know,
right.
Even though I don't think they're very good. Now, if this was a personal project that I was working on, or, you know, even while I was shooting them, how did I know that I had enough? Well, you know, that's the other thing people ask me all the time. You're taking pictures of somebody. How do you know when you've got enough?
Right.
That you've got what you need. Well,
would you put these photos in your portfolio, even though you don't like them, but someone else did? Does there a sort of a re-quantification of
I see what
good?
You're saying. It's, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, she was a difficult subject. So in the sense of you got good pictures of a difficult subject, sure. You know, it was definitely not some really good looking actor, actress who knew how to be in front of the camera and every picture came out great. You know, it was a challenge, which in its own way might be seen by people who look at my portfolio and go, oh, you could tell she was really difficult, but he did a good job. So therefore, yeah, I'm going to hire him because he's good in a pinch, you know, like with the tough ones.
Right. But then there might be other people that have your same.
Who are just like, oh, that's not a,
and went,
that's not
why
an
is
amazing
that on
picture.
Here?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, you know, if I wanted to have just beautiful portraits, then if I did nothing but shoot beautiful people, that would make my life a lot easier, you know, if that's what I was going for. But it's just it's a difficult thing. And I mean, even again, in my own like project work, there's lots of things where it's like I'll do something, I'll be like, eh, it's okay, you know. But then there's other things that I do and I really like that don't get a lot of response. So it's really difficult to do. Ultimately, you have to decide for yourself whether it's satisfying for you to invest the time.
Sure.
You know, ultimately your own satisfaction of either doing the work or improving because of failure, which is a whole other thing that comes into this, you know, yeah, maybe Bobby's shoot didn't work, or, you know, he brought some girl out to a field to take some pictures and he didn't have enough power in the speed lights to overpower the sun or whatever he wanted to do, right?
Sure.
Because it was the first time he's done it. I'm just throwing something out there. Well, you know what? Maybe it didn't work this time, and you go home and you don't get any good pictures, or you didn't get what you planned to get.
Right.
But now you know next time that you need more power, and you go and you do it again. That's learning, right? That's
sure.
That's the process.
Sure, sure, sure.
So there's a lot of stuff in there that's it's a charged topic, I guess is my point. It's interesting.
Yes.
I don't know.
But you do know. And that's the thing is
well, I know as well as anybody, I guess is what I'm saying.
You know what works for you.
Yes. Well, I think I know what works for me, right?
This is hard to answer definitively, Bobby, because you know, obviously we don't know your situation, and these are very sort of broad strokes. A concept that's a little nebulous.
Yeah.
You know, if a concept doesn't work, try looking at it a little differently.
I will say that I've almost never gone into a shoot with a concept and come out with exactly what I was planning on getting. And that doesn't mean that I failed. Sometimes I came up with something better in the heat of the moment. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, well, you have an idea of what you're going to do, and you get there and you go, oh, this is actually better if I shot it from this direction instead of that direction. I mean, that kind of stuff happens all the time.
Sure.
You know.
You know, it's funny. I didn't even think about it until just now. The whole idea of enough time versus this just isn't going to work, I could bring Faded and Blurred into that.
Yep, sure.
You know, I've been working up until 2015. I had been working on Faded and Blurred for 5 years.
Right.
And thinking early on that, now keep in mind that, you know, sites like Petapixel and F-Stoppers and, you know, I think Foblographer, we all kind of started around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But
you have a different angle on your content than those guys.
Yeah. I mean, regardless, I thought when we first kind of decided, oh, let's make it this, I thought that it was going to be giant. I thought that,
yeah.
that it was going to be big and people were going to, you know, going to come all the time and, you know, AOL was going to buy us or, you know, whoever, you know, and I was going to cash some fat check and then walk away. It didn't work that way.
Yeah.
And it got to a point where I felt like I was just adding to the noise.
Yeah.
I felt like I was just adding to, you know, there was nothing really there that you couldn't see on five other sites. And so
do you think, and this is not a rip on any of our friends at those other sites, but there's a lot of cross pollination going on.
Sure there is.
Do you think they feel that way?
Yes, I know they do. Okay. I know for a fact they do.
Okay.
But they
have yet to find a way to differentiate.
Without.
Sure. But there hasn't been an answer as how to differentiate in such a way that is successful.
Well, look, if you've got, you know, 30 or 40 writers writing for you that you're paying, well, you've created this beast that needs to be fed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've got to have tons of ads. You've got to have tons of
link baity
articles.
Yep.
You've got to have, you have become a slave to the click.
Yep.
You have become beholden to the like.
Right.
And
but you wouldn't be there making a living if you weren't.
Or sure.
At least no one else has figured out how to do it. Right. So that's the sucky part of it.
That's true. For me, it got to the point where I wanted to shift. I wanted to do more conversational content,
sure,
for lack of a better word. And I started talking to people more. I wanted, you know, this was what the first two sort of beta episodes or test episodes of process driven, then called In Process, are though the talks are good, and I'm really, you know, excited to have gotten a chance to sit down. The setup for them is very NPR. Hi, I'm Jeffrey Storrs, sure. And today, and I'm trying to find my way. I'm trying to find what works for me. So again, going back to Bobby's question, I'm trying to find whether it's me, whether it's my approach. And if you listen to the second two, the talks with Dalton Campbell and David Duchemin, there's a lot more energy in the intro. There's a tonal shift. And I think once I bring the thing back, the third time will be the charm. Okay. What I'm working on now is more me. It feels like more not what I expect or want or hope people will like, but I'm doing the interviews and I'm doing the conversations that I want to listen to.
Sure.
And I think you can see a little bit of that on Craft and Vision. And will it work? I don't know. I don't know if it'll work. All I can do is, you know, what did Gandhi say? Be the change in the world you want to see.
Yeah. Be the change you want to see in the world.
Be the change you want to see in the world. All I can do is have the conversations that I would like to listen to.
Do you think that's the case with art in general? That I tend to think that I want to take the kind of portraits that I like to see.
I hope that's the case, because I think that's the most honest.
Right. And that's getting back to the whole, you can't control who you fall in love with.
Right. You know? If you're painting, you know, if Andrew Salgado, who's one of my recent favorite artists, for example, and if you have not seen his work, look him up. He is phenomenal. And he's one of the people that I would love to talk to. In fact, there's a documentary, a short documentary about the creation of his last body of work that is absolutely superb. It's so great to watch him talk through it. We don't actually get to see him paint, which I'm kind of disappointed at, Andrew, if you are listening. I don't think he does. But if you do, I'd like to see your brush in motion. But this idea of painting what the work that you want to see, I think gives us a more accurate representation of who that artist is. You know, you photographing the kind of photographs that you want to look at, we may not like them. We may like them. We may think X, Y, or Z, but at the very least, we're seeing an honesty that is true to you. We're seeing your aesthetic.
Yeah. In some ways, is there any other option?
Sure. There are.
I mean, I'm just saying that you could argue that the only true art is the art that the artist wants to make.
Sure. And I hope that there's at least some semblance of truth to that, but there are a lot of people that you know, look, there are musicians that know how to write hooks.
Sure.
And they write the hooks. There are actors that have done, you know, movies for money.
Yep.
Not because it represented what they had to say or they had any connection to the project other than, you know, dot the I and cross the T and, you know, put a zeros on it.
There was a really good, I was listening to a podcast. God, I can't remember who it is. I think it was with some actor. And one of the guys said, you know, why is it that actors are one of the few jobs where if you're doing it for the paycheck, you're wrong. You know, that people are just like, oh, he phoned that one in because he wanted the paycheck. It's like,
well, one reason is because it's one of the only professions where you get paid in perpetuity for one job.
Yeah. I guess his meaning was why can't art just be a job sometimes? Which is an interesting argument.
It probably can. And I'm not saying it can't. I'm just saying that when it's not, the odds are that it gets closer to who the artist really is.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Yeah.
Man, it's heavy stuff today.
It is heavy stuff today. That's how we roll over here.
We don't mess around.
Hey, you know what?
What?
That's the deal. You know, you buckle up, mister, because that's what you get.
I just wish the answers were,
life is not a Scantron sheet.
Nope. No, right. Nor a box of chocolates.
Yeah. You don't just, you know, use a number two pencil and press hard.
Yeah.
It's not, I wish it was that easy.
There's always this, the perspective that, you know, oftentimes you and I discuss this stuff as if it were life or death.
It is.
Right.
It is. And to your point, I want to jump in here.
Sure.
You said something either last week or a couple weeks ago that, like, well, it's not like it's life or death. And I've been thinking about that since. It is life or death.
Well, it's life or death in the sense that you know, relationships are life and death, or, you know what I mean? Like anything else in life, in the sense that it is what we do to make life worth living.
Sure. But how many artists, how many musicians, how many people have died for their art?
Absolutely. But usually those people have other problems going on.
Yeah. But
at the same time, is if you write a bad piece or paint a bad painting, or I take a bad photograph, no one dies. You know, you can always do another one.
Sure. Maybe, but maybe it leads to depression, and maybe that depression leads to death.
Sure. But we've
seen examples of it across the board. Robin Williams.
Yeah, sure.
Michael Hutchence.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, two off the top of my head, but there have been many where this creative struggle, it is a struggle. It can be a struggle, and it can be life and death, and it is not something to be trifled with.
I'm not saying it's to be trifled with, but I think that those people in those examples had deeper problems that even if they were artists or whether they were soldiers or whether they were, you know, chefs, would have had similar fates. I don't think it was their art that ruined them. You know?
Okay. Fair enough.
I just think that there is, while all of the things that we talk about are very, very important, there are actual life or death things going on all the time, which when you step back, some of these questions, like he's asking of, you know, how do you know when it's enough? Like, how do you know when to stop? How do you know when to try something new? Well, you know what? The good thing is there really are no wrong answers, because any answer that you take could be that if you spend more time on it, you could make it work. But it could also be true that if you stop working on that, it'll lead you to something else, which is something different, which would be even more successful. But we don't know, right? This is all just, you know, sure, rolling the dice every single time. But the good thing about it is that that is true, that there's always the opportunity for, I don't know. There's always opportunity for joy around the next corner, you know,
if you can get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you can get there.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a surprising, startling, you know, humbling number of people, they just can't get there. And
sure.
And I'm not going to minimize someone else's struggle because I'm not in their shoes.
Oh, I'm certainly not minimizing their struggle. What I'm saying is, when in doubt, take a step back and take a breath.
Yeah, but sometimes this coming from the guy who's been in therapy for how many years?
Absolutely. I have dealt with this crap for 40 years. But what I've learned in those 40 years is what I'm saying. You know, mm-hmm, I can mm-hmm. only say that because I've been to therapy for
sure,
years.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know, is my point.
Fair enough.
And it's you know, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
What else we got? We got lots of other stuff. We are about almost 50 minutes in already.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, that was good. That was good. Hey, one of the guys that that Bill and I both are, I think I can say that, are fans sure. of is Sebastio Salgado. And there is a new documentary.
Wait, hold on a second. You got to say his name right.
Is it not Sebastio?
No, that's fine, but I need the accent.
Sebastio Salgado.
Thank you.
Is that the one? That's the only accent that I know.
That's what it's I was like, looking for. Go
Stefan
ahead.
Stefan Louvo. You know, Robert Duano. You know, it's the only one I know. And in the New York Times Lens blog, which if you don't read that, it is a fantastic blog, has a little story on it. Sebastio Salgado has won every major prize a photographer can receive. With his crisp, compassionate black and white images, many from war zones and other locations of human suffering, hanging on the walls of museums, galleries, and private collections around the world. I wish he would hang one on my wall. his books, including Workers, Migrations, Sahel, is that how you pronounce that? S-A-H-E-L, Sahel?
Could be.
And most recently, the nature-oriented Genesis, which I do have consistently met with commercial and critical success. Now, as if to complete the picture, a documentary film about Mr. Salgado, 71, and his work is about to open in theaters across the United States. So it's called The Salt of the Earth, and man, does it look good.
Yeah, it does look good. It's supposed to come out in the next couple weeks.
Yeah.
And I think it's opening in New York and LA, I think. So,
yeah.
In fact, I looked up yesterday trying to find the theater that it's going to play in New York, and there was no answer to my question.
Yeah.
So apparently it's still working.
Much looking forward to it, not only because it is Salgado, but it was directed by Wim Wenders, who is a terrific director.
And Salgado's son worked on it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you would like to see a fantastic Wim Wenders film, check out Wings of Desire.
Okay.
Which was it was ripped off and made into City of Angels with Nick Cage and Meg Ryan.
Nick Cage and Meg Ryan. There's a really great City of Angels. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a really, really great Alanis Morissette song on that soundtrack. That was recorded at Ocean Way, I think. Alan Sides, I think, did it. This famous engineer, he owns these studios out in California, out in LA. And in the late 80s, he went over to Eastern Europe when all this stuff was falling apart and bought up all of these really old Telefunken and old German microphones from back in the day were like left over there, you know, from back in the communist days, and took them all home. Bought them for a song, took them home, listened to all of them, like played with all of them, chose the best ones, sold the rest, which paid for everything.
Wow.
So he basically ended up with this world-class, like once one-of-a-kind collection of like nearly perfect microphones for free.
Wow.
In the end. Anyway, he recorded that, and it's a really good song. Anyway, but yes, we will go check that out.
Also, another one of my favorite flicks is by Wim Wenders. It's called The American Friend.
Which one's that?
Bruno Ganz, Dennis Hopper.
You like the W's as V's? You like that?
Wouldn't that be right?
I think it's correct. It's just very strange sounding to me.
Yeah.
You know. When it comes out, we'll have to make
he did Paris, Texas.
And, yeah, yeah. I'll put a link to his website in here.
Yeah, I'm sure he's got a wiki or something.
He's got a giant website.
Oh, he does?
Yeah.
Is it just vimvenders.com?
Photos. Yeah, yeah. vims-vendors.com. There you go.
.com. Oh, look at that.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, neat.
Answers to your questions.
Oh, wow. Yeah. This is cool. Okay. Thank you for this. Yeah. I didn't even know about it. I'd never even thought to look.
See the internet. It's amazing. The stuff that's on there.
Wow.
You know,
wowzers.
No, I'm not going to say it, cause I'll just get more crap in the group for it. But, all right. What else? So a little sad news in the industry, Paul Buff of Paul Buff Industries, who makes a lot of flashes that many of
Alien Bees, White Lightning, Einsteins,
died last week, at the age of 78. And according to, what you can sort of glean from the, obituary and whatnot, it seems like he must have had some sort of long-term illness, but very sad, but the company is going to obviously keep going on. So, if you're a big fan of that stuff, but what?
Look at this.
What?
Paul started his own music recording business called PAL in Cucamonga, California in the 1960s.
That's
okay.
You.
Okay. Yeah. That's.
Wait, what's the difference between Cucamonga and Rancho Cucamonga?
Name.
The same thing.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, they sound better. I know exactly where this is. It's now a tattoo shop.
Really?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That's funny.
If that's the building I'm thinking of, it's on the street that I live on. It's just down.
I have often walked down this street before.
How crazy. Wow, look at that.
It's quite literally on the street where you live.
On the street where I live.
I'm a big fan of Paul's stuff. I think he, for the money, he makes fantastic stuff. And he was, you know what I like about him? He seemed like one of those guys who was the engineer's engineer. You know, like, there's got to be a better way to do this. I'm going to figure it out. To hell with the orthodoxy of whatever it is that I'm doing.
Sure.
In recording or photographic stuff or what have you. So it's just kind of cool. I mean, a lot of people thought that he was a little crazy or uptight or opinionated, but like, I was okay with that because he seemed like
You're a little crazy and uptight and opinionated.
It's true.
Ha!
He seemed like it was all about quantification, right? You know, like, mm-hmm. if it's a thing, show me a measurement that says this is better, you know, which is always kind of what I like. Good for, you know, sad that he died, but good that he was alive to make us stuff. I had no idea, though, that he was, that he died. You mentioned it to me. Patrick mentioned it to you.
Patrick,
I wonder where
Patrick
figured it out, found out.
I don't know. He Patrick texted me the other day.
We'll put a link in the show notes to that.
Yeah.
So we got some stuff after the new assignment. So what are you?
Yeah. Okay. So really good stuff in the group. Wow. David Gardner just added. David, I'm right there with you. This bridge shot, Star Wars movie theater. Wow. I was 10. So you were 17. That's cool. The opening scene of Star Wars. Talking about this photo. It's like a shot underneath a bridge, and it's reminiscent of that sort of Star Destroyer scene coming in.
Sure.
Speaking of Star Wars, I just watched that Drew Struzan documentary.
Okay, which one's that?
Drew Struzan is the guy that did basically every iconic poster for every movie you've ever seen.
Oh, okay.
All
this
the Star
is a documentary
Wars
documentary about him?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's on Netflix. Let me get the link. But
keep going. I'll find it.
Back to the Future posters, E.T., the Star Wars Special Edition, the Blade Runner, the iconic Blade Runner poster. One of my favorite posters by him is the one for Big Trouble in Little China with Kurt Russell.
Which is a very strange movie.
Jack Burton. Love that movie.
Of course you do. I will find the man behind the poster.
Did you? Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
You saw. Do you remember the name of his truck?
I do not.
The Pork Chop Express.
I have only seen that movie in bits and pieces. I have. He did Back to the Future too.
Yeah, he did all the Back to the Futures. Yep. And if you look at the, it's kind of cool because he talks about the Back to the Future posters, the sort of imagery behind them and how they. It's a really good documentary. And now he's doing his own personal stuff because he just kind of got tired of the industry. Anyway, Faceless Portrait is what we were talking about last week. And I love it. Some of you went kind of literal. Some of you went more abstract. Bobby put some stuff up. Mitch put some stuff up.
Yeah.
David Lawrence. Let's see. Millie. Jason Peterson. Yeah, I like that. Light through the blinds, Jason. Good stuff.
I like the shot of that Charles took of the probably girl with a motorcycle helmet on.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. Yeah, yeah. I love the interpretations of what's going on here. And just some other stuff. Oh, this is funny. Nicholas Govis, Spring in Little Italy. And it's the Little Italy sign and it's snowing.
Yeah, that's about right. It snowed again the other day. It was crazy.
Yeah.
I think we're all kind of done with it here.
Lauren Shin, great Faceless Portrait doing the blur. A lot of people are trying out the blur. I think did Matheson, was he the first one to kind of start that, the really out of focus stuff and just kind of,
you know, the funny thing
on the
about
group anyway,
the blurred face thing. Now it reminds me of that TV show, The Flash, which, in order to hide himself, he just moves really fast back and forth. So it just ends up being like this blur of his face. It's a good effect. It was a good idea. Whoever came up with it, but that's what I see when I see this stuff.
So yeah, lots of good stuff. Max next. Max, I want to see this book. Patrick just got it. The Preservation, the guy, Blake Little, the guy that drenched everyone in honey and then photographed
them. Oh yeah,
that's
a weird set.
Some beautiful photographs in there.
Yeah, I don't like honey.
Well, you know, he used like 900 quarts of honey to make these photos.
Where do you buy honey in bulk?
I don't know.
That's a lot of honey.
That's a lot of honey.
Imagine trying to get that off.
That would be a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, go ahead.
So lots of good stuff. Some new posters. So welcome new folks. Thank you for posting. So this week, I like the one, Danny Alexander, how they usually look anyways, his kids behind the screens of their devices.
Yeah, yeah, I saw
that's
that
great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Nice one, Danny. Oh, I'm getting lost in some of these. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Sorry. I'm just like scrolling through going, God, these are good. Martin Rotz. That's a nice one too. Good light. Damn you people. Ugh. Anyway. Okay. So, typography.
Okay.
Typography. And the reason is I was, you know, I'm a fan of the field notes.
Sure.
The little field notes notebooks. I have
600 of them.
Let's just say many. They came out with a new series called the Two Rivers Edition for spring. And what they've done is they've gone to the Hamilton Wood Type and Printing Museum, which was an extension now of – it's all that's left of the Hamilton Manufacturing Company, which according to field notes – produced much of the wood type used to print America's headlines and broadsides from 1880 through the mid 20th century. That's and they've cool. gone to, yeah, it's really neat. So they've gone to these people and they've created these collages, that are printed in two colors, on a limited run of these notebooks. And the effect of them is just great because you've got these colors combining one with the other.
Sure.
Also then combining with the color of the paper underneath it, and no two are alike. They've printed, well, I'm sure eventually two are alike, but they are different because the way they die cut the covers. So
they're all offset from each other.
Yeah, they're all offset from each other. And I love the whole letterpress and the wood type. And it just kind of got me thinking about signage and typography. And so get out into the world and let's see some signage, whether it's a sign on your favorite restaurant or a vintage sign or type or, you know, type treatment that you happen to like.
Type is ever. In fact, you know, I'll tell you, in cities, sometimes it's hard not to get type in a picture.
Yeah.
Because who was it? Jamie Azell has a big thing where he says, you know, if you're going to have type in the picture, any type in the picture is going to take over the picture.
Sure.
Sort of his mantra.
Well, and it was, you know, now here we go. Now see what I'm doing here for you. We're playing volleyball, Bill, and I'm setting you up.
Okay.
Right. Because part of what I was, that got me thinking about all this typography also was some of the stuff that you had posted, the experiments with Craig, your friend Craig.
Sure.
Who is a super talented graphic designer and
very
Craig,
fancy type designer. Yeah.
Yeah. Craig, I hate you just a little. Mm-hmm. but I mean that in the best way possible. And so I've just been thinking about typography for a while. You did some high speed photographs of typography, which led you to
learn a lot about flashes.
Right.
Is that where we're going?
I'm setting you up. I'm leading
you. So a few weeks ago, we were talking about flashes and high speed stuff and why it was hard to get really fast flashes and what made them fast. And if they are fast, why there's a color shift. Remember we were talking about that stuff?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Is it too heavy for you? Too deep for you?
No, I remember the follow-up email that we...
Oh, right. Carl yelled at us. But that's typical.
No. Let's be clear. He didn't yell at us because us didn't answer the question.
Well, so I've done a bunch of research on flashes and how this all works, which gets us into our photographer of the week. But before we get into that, I wanted to answer some of these questions. So apparently... flash tubes, you know, we all know how they work, right? Like there's gas in this sealed tube.
Apparently you didn't 2 weeks ago.
Well, no, I mean, I we know the basics of it, right? Electricity gets zapped into a gas, normally xenon for reasons which I will discuss in a minute, which turns it to plasma, which brings some of the atoms to a higher state. And when they fall down, they let go of light, and the light is what we're looking for. This stuff is pretty cool. So it turns out that xenon, because of certain physical aspects of it, gives you very daylight balanced light when you pop a flash into it. And usually what they do the electricity is they charge some capacitors, and then they, which like to sort of store instantaneous electricity, and just sort of dump those capacitors into the flash tube. And that's how you do the light. Now, old flashes used to do this by having banks of flash tubes. So old flashes where it was half power, quarter power, eighth power, that kind of stuff. Basically what they were doing was just turning on and off banks of capacitors to change the power going into the flash tube. See what I'm saying?
Sure.
Which is actually a pretty slick way of doing it. And that's why things were very sort of switch-based in old-school strobes. So speedotrons, old Profoto, that kind of stuff. Nowadays, they can do all kinds of tricks in order to play with this. Now, we were talking about fast flashes, which this Einstein that I own, I don't do a lot of this high-speed stuff, but Craig needed to do some high-speed stuff, and I said, sure, we can do it. So... The Einstein has a high speed mode, which is very, very fast, like a T.1, which is it the time after the flash goes off by the point where the power is 10% what it was before. So T.1. So 0.1 of what the power was, the peak power. Does that make sense? So,
sure.
So the power dumps into the flash tube. The power, the light comes out, bow, and then it kind of dribbles out at the end. It sort of tails off, like if you close your eyes after staring at something and it kind of fades away. And they measure these flash times by how quickly you get to 10% of the max output. It's called T.1. I noticed in the Paul Buff ones that if you do turn it into speed mode, it's not as accurate when it comes to color temperature. And the reason that is, which is what I've learned, is that flash tubes, xenon flash tubes, or all flash tubes, but we'll use xenon one because that's what we're talking about. The light that comes out of them over the course of the flash is different color temperatures, but that it centers around what we want, which is around 5,500 daylight. Right. So when it first flashes, it's more blue. And as it sort of dims slowly, it gets it goes down into warmer colors. So it goes down into yellow. And the practical upshot of this is that over the course of the time of the flash, the average color temperature is somewhere in the middle around 5,500. And that is why a normal flash sits you at 5,500, even though the color temperature is bluer to redder over the course of the flash, but it averages out to what we're looking for. However, the way that these super high speed flashes work is that they use a transistor to basically cut off the power to the flash, so that what you end up getting is more blue, and they cut it off before it can backfill the red further along of the curve. If that makes sense, it's hard to do without a diagram.
No, it makes sense.
Okay, so yeah, so basically you get more blue and less red.
Okay, what's responsible for the inconsistencies in lower cost flash units that aren't able to as consistent?
Right. Well, that has to do with how the capacitors get charged and the quality of the electronics and the whole thing. But I mean, okay, even cheap ones are in the grand scheme of things consistent enough. Right, you know, even like the really junky ones, like this. But this Einstein that I have in color mode is accurate to within like 50 degrees, right? But when you put it in speed mode, it can go a lot higher. Now, this isn't that big of a deal if you're using one light, because you can always, you know, deal with it after the fact.
Sure.
But that's sort of a limitation of physics, right? So as Carl pointed out, the fancy $12,000 Broncolor lights can keep a constant color temperature at high speed flashes. And basically what they're doing is they are cutting it off the same way everybody else is at the end, which very few flashes actually do the high speed stuff. But the temperature, the peak temperature that it gets to in the beginning is dependent on power. So the more power you blast into it, the more blue shift there is at the beginning. So what Broncolor is doing is they're doing a whole lot of math and controlling that curve so that they don't put as much power in at the beginning. So there's less blue, so that when they cut it off at the end, it still averages around 5,500. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So that's basically what's going on. So they have better computers doing the calculations. So yes, they're really good at it. But as I showed you, I can't really show everybody yet because it's sort of still NDA'd. Right. But I showed you some of the work that Craig and I did, and they looked great. You know, we did these splashes.
Looks terrific.
You know what I ended up using was I did some tests, and a friend of mine said, "Are you using laser triggers?" And
right.
I said, "I hadn't thought of using laser triggers."
Yeah, you got those.
Did we talk about
them last week?
I think I mentioned it. So, but you know, just as a final thing, I bought laser triggers, which, you know, when your thing passes through the beam, that's when the flash goes off. And I used it this weekend to do the drop of cream on the black. I did a Edgerton knockoff.
An homage to our photographer of the week.
To our photographer of the week. Which is what I was getting to. Yeah, right. Which is Harold, or otherwise known as Doc Edgerton.
I love that he's got a doc.
Apparently, people at MIT knew him as Doc. Like, he was known around campus as Doc. Now, Edgerton was, if you've seen the pictures of the bullet going through a playing card or a balloon popping mid-pop where the balloon is decompressing and stuff.
Or the apple. That's a pretty famous one.
The apple, right. The balloon, there's a bullet going through the apple, which apparently he referred to as making applesauce.
Nice. Nice.
And we're going to put a bunch of links in the show notes, including a couple cute documentaries. In fact, he won an Oscar for a documentary that he was involved in 1940, which was a short form documentary about this high speed photography stuff. It's on YouTube. You can watch it. So I'm going to put that in the show notes. But the cool thing about all this is that this is the guy who basically invented what we know as strobe photography today. What are you looking
at?
His pictures?
Atomic bomb explosion.
Right. So
one 100 millionth of a second exposure.
Right. So this guy is working on a whole other ball of wax.
Yes.
So he was an engineer at MIT, and he started working on, he wanted to make high speed photographs to figure out some engineering problems with some motors that he was working on. And so he came up with, he sort of pioneered the use of these noble gas flashes. And basically, he's the guy who figured out that xenon was the right gas to use because of its color spectrum. And so he had all this stuff custom made. He ended up getting hired by the Atomic Energy Commission to do these very high-speed shots, photographs of nuclear explosions during the 50s and 60s, that whole thing. And then
great motion of like golf swings, things like that. It's motion studies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So he ended up working with, for his whole life, apparently it was like a lifelong thing. I'm sure he worked with other people, with a guy named Jijon Miele.
Okay.
Who, was a photographer who, if you look him up, and I'm going to send you a thing. It's Jijon Miele. He is the guy who, worked on a lot of those things with him. And if you look him up on Wikipedia, the image stuff that you get is exactly what you think you'd get, which is all these sort of strobe effects of Gene Krupa playing drums.
Yeah.
Or he's the guy who did those pictures of Picasso light painting.
Yep.
So this guy shot.
Why don't we do a twofer for Photographer of the Week?
I was going to do that. Yeah.
Okay, good.
So this guy worked with him on all this stuff, and basically using strobes for artistic effect and motion studies and all kinds of great stuff. And
yeah, this is great.
It's really, really, really cool stuff.
Wow.
And so in some ways, Edgerton is a good guy because not only is he a photographer, he's also sort of the guy who invented the tool that we all use.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, another aside to the flash stuff. Apparently, small speed lights tend to use the transistor trick to cut off the end of the flash, which is why speed lights can be used in high speed photography very well. Like you could gang up a few speed lights, and at 30-second power, they're as fast as the Broncolor or my Einstein. You know, at like medium to lower powers.
Interesting.
They're really, really fast because they use the same technology that's used in the bigger flashes for high speed stuff.
Interesting.
So if you want to play with high speed photography and you have a speed light, you can definitely do that.
Certain types, I would imagine.
Actually, almost all of them. In fact, all of them, when you pull them down a little bit, are really fast, much faster than your average light. So anyway, that's interesting stuff, right?
Edgerton. Yeah, this Gijon, how do you pronounce it?
I listened to a kid and he said Gijon.
Gijon?
I think Gijon. So.
Mealy. Wow. Yeah, what a great...
Cool stuff, right?
Yeah.
But see, that's what's interesting about it is that he was doing something using technology that was invented by another guy, and the two of them worked together to
that's
make
great.
It, you know?
That's great.
Which is what's kind of cool about it.
Yeah, that's great.
So we will put both of them in the show notes. Definitely go check them out. And that's about it.
I think that's it.
What else was I going to say? I think that's about it.
I think that's it. Good stuff.
You got anything else?
I got nothing.
Okay.
I am showed out today.
I know. It's exhausting.
This was good stuff.
It
is.
It's a deep one.
Podcast at ontakingpictures.com.
Yep.
You can leave us a voicemail, 347-687-9411. If you call and it's busy, that just means that Tom from Michigan is leaving a message, so try again later.
Wait, can a Google voice thing actually go busy?
I don't know. That would be kind of cool, though.
Yeah. We love Tom.
I mean, think about how many kids don't even know what a busy signal is.
Yeah, it's true.
That's weird to think about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow. Okay. that's really weird. Now I'm going to be thinking about that today. All right. Or Bill tweets at Bill Wadman. I tweet at Jeffrey Sidoris. What is your Instagram thing? Is it just Bill Wadman?
Bill Wadman. Should I have used a fancier one?
No. Mine's just Jeffrey Sidoris. And again, I dig what the paper things that you've been putting up recently. Yeah. That was fun.
A coworker of Conrad's is Booty Panda.
Right.
I always see that kind of stuff. I'm like, should I do something like that? Is that what I need?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But yeah, I'm Bill Wadman on Instagram.
Cool.
So till next week.
Yep. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. We'll see you. Tell a friend. Tell five friends.
Yeah.
Tell 10 friends. Go tweet about it. Post about it. Tell them you love the show.
Yep.
And there's a crisp 5 spot in it for each and every one of you from Bill.
What? Wait a minute.
You see how I did that?
Damn it. Just when I thought I was getting out of the way.
What? Wait, what?
Yeah. What the? Who the what? All right, we'll talk to you later.
All right, have a good week, everyone.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way, say what you want to say.